anniversary of the first atomic bomb dropped in warfare on the city of Hiroshima, Japan. Probably be some mention of it in the news, I would guess. The Japanese, as you know, did not surrender, and a second atomic bomb was dropped on the city of Nagasaki. The death toll for both bombs was over 200,000 people immediately, and then I'm sure radiation poisoning got a bunch more after that time. Really a horrendous thing, and the specter of a mushroom cloud off in the horizon is a very frightening possibility today. I've shared before that one of the physicians that I used to call on told me that he had treated one of his patients with a drug that I promoted, and this patient had been only 1 mile from ground zero in Hiroshima. She was only a six-year-old girl in Japan, and miraculously, somehow, she survived a blast that killed virtually everyone else around her. One day at lunch, the physician was excited to share with me that the patient had benefited greatly, and the bone mineral density in his patient that he had put on the product that I was selling at the time, and she had done very, very well. And a little backstory, when we launched this product, and Steve was one of my trainers, by the way, the man that gave the sermonette, and really rigorous trainer, so it's no wonder that he is a mentor to younger people, because he was my mentor as well. But when he was training me, and when we were being trained by the company in 2002 and launched the product, he and I, along with 166 other reps, had to go through like the most extensive training for any product that we have ever launched or that we had promoted. But we specifically bargained for about 30 minutes of time, which is unheard of in the medical world. You just never sit down with a physician for 30 minutes. But in each case, people that were initially launching the product to, we were told to sit down, and we had memorized a 30-page booklet of information that we needed to share with the, it may have been 35, it may have been 40, who knows, it was a lot. But it was tiny print too. We had to memorize this, and you know, it's when you have to do something, it's not as hard as you would suspect, but you know, we had to have this down perfectly according to the FDA. But one of the things that we were specifically told we had to really go over this is that this product should not be used in patients who had been exposed to excessive radiation throughout their lives. And I had to tell the doctor, you know, look, you may have forgotten that part about it, because this woman absolutely is probably subjected to more radiation in her lifetime, in that very brief time, than any other person in the history of mankind. But she was doing well. Anyway, I was happy that she did well, but the individual physician had forgotten the warning to do that. The doomsday clock was created by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in 1947. It now stands at 90 seconds to midnight, signaling our presence, all of us together, living together in one of the most dangerous times in human history. The nuclear might of the mid-20th century, which has not been used since World War II, is unbelievable, and certainly the ability to kill all life on planet Earth is exceeded by hundreds of times in the arsenals, the nuclear arsenals of the developed world. My title today is The Leadership Crisis in the 21st Century, and I think it's important to comment on this or to speak on this particular topic because it is these individuals that are taking the world to the potential of nuclear nightmare and annihilation. In last week's sermon, I spoke about the philosophers that range from the 16th to the 19th century who influenced the events of the 20th century. In fact, their ideas from Darwin to Marx and Engels, from the various philosophers, Rousseau and various other ones, those ideas germinated in the 19th century, were taught in the institutions of higher learning for about 100 years, and then finally they came to fruition in an idea that might makes right and the survival of the fittest and a number of other Marxist philosophies over the years that have actually been responsible for, in the 20th century, for killing over 150 million people. As we move forward in time, it's important to understand how the events of Bible prophecy are going to unfold. Today, we're going to concentrate on the importance of leaders of the 21st century, those individuals who are going to influence the events and are influencing the events of today and tomorrow as we move towards the future. But first, I'd like to examine some potential common misconceptions that could affect our understanding of Bible prophecy in the world that we live in. And I'll have to admit, I'm guilty sometimes in using some of these ideas. Maybe not all of them, but let's cover three quick, well, maybe we won't be quick, but let's cover three misconceptions that people have had about leadership in the world in terms of Bible prophecy. I'm not talking about, you know, the man on the street. I'm talking about seasoned individuals within the Church of God who have had ideas. And, you know, the ones that they have gotten those ideas from, for the most part, have probably been those of us in the ministry. So blanket forgiveness for all three, although I may not have always believed and preached about these three ideas. I think, you know, we can trace a source back to the ministry in most cases. The first common misconception is this: God places worldly leaders in their positions. Now, this idea assumes that not only does God allow leaders their personal positions, but he actually has had a hand in placing them in these positions, whether they're prime ministers or kings or presidents or whatever. And I guess the notion is kind of innocent in one sense, that since God is in control of all events, then maybe he's responsible, and there's some biblical backing to that or some thought, and it's found in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17. So let's examine this passage. I've talked about it in the past, and you know, maybe you agree with me or not. I'm just going to say this is my opinion, developed independently, but I will reject the notion that God places all world leaders in their position, okay? So that's just the way I feel. But Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17 says this: in evaluating the dream of Nebuchadnezzar at this particular point, it says, "This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men." So that particular verse has been extrapolated to mean that God places all world leaders in their position. So I guess my question would be, in objection to that, how far do we take it? Does it mean every single person through history? Are we able to get that passage up? I don't know, guys, but does that mean every single senator or congressman throughout the ages, or prince or king or whomever? Does that apply to in every single instance? So for some people, that's exactly what it seems to indicate, that God chooses everyone, or that he allows who he wants throughout man's history. But is that verified by Scripture? Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 27 and verse 5. And Jeremiah was a prophet of the Babylonian captivity, or a prophet just before the Babylonian captivity of the nation of Judah. Of course, he was older, but kind of a contemporary prophet in the same time period, from the time of the captivity of Judah throughout the time of them being in Babylon. But Jeremiah wrote of this incident in Jeremiah 27 and verse 5, "I have made the earth, the man and beast that are on the ground, by my great power and by my outstretched arm, and have given it to whom seemed proper to me." And that's God speaking. "And now I've given all these lands," specifically referring to the prophecies against Judah, I've given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. God says that Nebuchadnezzar, as evil a person as he was, as a despicable despot as he was being used by God at this particular time as his servant to punish and to take away Judah from their own homeland into Babylon. And all the beasts of the field I have also given him to serve him. So all nations shall serve him and his son's son, until the time of his land comes, and then many nations and great kings shall make him serve them. So predicting the downfall of Babylon later on. So the context of this prophecy was that during the reign of Jehoiakim, who was the king of Judah at the time, and before Judah was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, specifically showing that God would use him to accomplish this single purpose, and that God allowed him and actually placed him in that position to be the one who would do God's purpose at that particular time. The statement in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17 refers to the specific interaction of God and Nebuchadnezzar. It's not, I submit to you, not intended to be taken universally that God chooses all world leaders through history. My opinion. Others may disagree, but I wanted to get that out of the way. Here's another one. Now, I'm definitely guilty of this, and I'll give you a little short story. It doesn't matter who the leader is. That is a national leader, international leader. It doesn't matter who it is. A variation of that would be within nations that have an electoral process and select their own leaders. A variation of that, it doesn't matter who is elected. And in fact, I was guilty of saying that in 1980, leading up to the presidential election of 1980 between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. I actually said that in a sermon. You know, sometimes, and I'm sure this feeling will come upon me at some time later too, even in this present age, sometimes I wish I could go back in time and put the earlier Steve on pause. You know, I would stand next to him as the older Steve, as younger Steve would be here, and I could tell the congregation in Rapid City, look, he's really young, he's only 28, he doesn't have much life experience, so the next few words that are going to come out of his mouth, look, most of you are older, you're probably a lot wiser than him, you've lived on this earth, you've done more things than him. There's going to be some things he says now, just a few minutes, because he's kind of paused now. I'm standing here. But sometimes I wish you could do that and just look, cut him some slack, because what he's about to say is pretty stupid. So just don't listen to him in this regard. And then what I said was, you know, in the sermon, you know, God is basically the whole reason for the sermon, I think. I was looking at these notes. I mean, sometimes you look at your notes from 20 or 30 years ago or last week, and you think, oh, man, that was stupid. Anyway. In retrospect, it's obvious. It's so obvious that there is an incredible difference between the presidency, and I'm not bagging on Jimmy Carter or calling him an evil dude or anything like that, by the way, but there's obviously, and I grew up during that. I mean, I was in the economy from 1976 to 1980, as many of you were. It was horrible. It was bad. It was because of policies and things that were going on during that time, and we find out that administrations do make a difference. So most people who are rational, normal people who lived during those times, and I went through the 80s, would agree that the transformation in the economy and in the nation, because of the leadership of Ronald Reagan, was transformational. It was incredible, and it actually fueled the biggest economic boom that this nation has ever known. Unfortunately, not all policies kind of jive together, and so it wasn't totally perfect, but it was like the incredible thing. And so It obviously did make a difference that Ronald Reagan was elected over Jimmy Carter in 1980 and Fritz Mondale in 1984. In fact, Fritz Mondale just barely won his own state of Minnesota. It was a landslide victory because people realized, oh, wow, this is incredible what has gone on in the last 4 years. And so later in 1986, I had to agree with the deacon who came to me at an in-home Bible study one night after the Bible study way out in the middle of nowhere, South Dakota. He said, I think it was just a very philosophical approach on his part, and he was accurate. He said, the years of the decade of the 80s have been really good. He says, I think we're going to look back and see it as one of the greatest decades that this nation has ever had. And he was right. I mean, many of you, some of you, maybe a couple of you are too young to remember that time, speaking of youth and such. But it was one of the most incredible decades of all. The deacon in the church in Rapid City was totally right. So the correct answer is that it does make a difference as to who is elected, or in the case of some elections, selected. As Christians, we should know that when it comes to world leaders, there is no moral equivalence. This is another idea that I kind of have attacked in a kind of a polite way. I think I attacked it in a polite way, but the idea of moral equivalence, this was an idea that went around, in my experience in teaching and being taught in the church, that since it doesn't really matter who is selected or who the leader is, because it's all going to end up the same prophetically, but what about the short term? But it does matter. There is, when it comes to world leaders, there's no moral equivalence. Some within the faith would say that this is not perfect and this is not perfect. This side is not perfect. This side is not perfect. So therefore, they're both the same. That is moral equivalence. I mean, I'm dumbing it down a little bit and explaining it. But by the same token, we would say that we're not perfect either, so does that make us bad? I mean, there is a difference between light and dark and right and wrong, so yes, there is a difference in world leaders. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5, I'm going to read this in the Amplified Bible. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5, Paul says, "We refute arguments and theories and reasonings in every proud and lofty thing that sets itself up against the true knowledge of God." See, that's, Paul is saying we reject that which is in opposition to God, and we lead every thought and purpose away captive into the obedience of Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One. So this passage emphasizes having discernment and the importance of aligning our thoughts and purposes with Christ. It doesn't suggest at all that all actions are equally valid, moral equivalence. It encourages the Christian to recognize and reject anything that opposes God's truth. And so when we see leaders who they may be imperfect, but one stresses law and order, justice, righteousness, obedience to law, and one does not, I mean, they're not all in the same bag, folks. That would be a moral inequivalence. In Proverbs 17 and verse 15, we read, "He who justifies the wicked and he who contemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord." So this verse highlights the importance of discerning in matters of justice, and it acknowledges that not all actions are morally equivalent. Some are clearly wrong, some are bad, some are evil even. God has an establishment, a standard of justice, and remains absolute himself. So just because each individual is not perfect, that doesn't mean that they're all wholly wrong. There are degrees. So when we understand that we're not perfect either, but we're supposed to learn how to discern between light and dark, then I think it should help clear that up. Here's the last of those three ideas that I'm opposed to. And I don't know, maybe some people think this idea or thought process is in the Bible. We get the leaders we deserve. Has anybody heard that? We get the leaders we deserve. Yeah. It comes from one of those worldly philosophers. I didn't retain his name, but actually he said, every nation gets the government it deserves. Now, that was his idea. Is it true? I don't think so. I think there are a lot of good people in Venezuela who over the past few years haven't gotten the government they deserve. This assumes that, okay, if you have free choice in the matter, if you're living in a nation where they have elections and you have free choice, this assumes that electing officials is kind of like ordering a pizza. You either get an incredible cheesy delight or you get a regrettable pineapple disaster catastrophe. Pineapple does not belong on pizza. If you believe it does, get out of here. Right now. Just kidding. Just kidding. Hey, come back. Don't leave. Wow, so sensitive. Obviously, when there's an electorate and a fair election, people can make bad decisions. But it's also true that one who is chosen can turn out quite differently than expected. So when these questions are asked, and now that we've gotten them out, and then I've just given my opinion, I'm not claiming infallibility here, okay? It's my opinion. I'm just giving you that. I just want to label it that. But let's address the world leadership crisis then and the ultimate solution. Before I get to that, there's one more qualification. If you're going to understand Bible prophecy thoroughly, completely, here's the statement. Israel is everything. Not the little nation state of Israel. Israel is everything. That is biblical Israel. Understanding biblical Israel is everything. Because understanding Bible prophecy requires you to understand who Israel is, not only historically and anciently, but I'm talking about the descendants of Joseph, Jacob, Ephraim, and Manasseh, anciently speaking, and who they are in the modern day. It's really important because if you don't know who these people are, anciently or today, it's going to be impossible for you to understand the future from here on. I mean, it'd be impossible for you to really comprehend Bible prophecy in its totality. Now, I know that not everybody is there, even at this stage of the game in the Church of God. But if you don't know who those folks are, then that's, okay, maybe not your fault. But if you don't know who they are in the Bible, it's problematic. And the reason is that the Bible is a book. It doesn't include the history of all nations, but it's a history book about Israel primarily. The 12 nations of Israel and the people who are their descendants. So if you don't know who those folks are, I'll just step away for a little while and let you get up to speed. Then I'll come back. Okay, no, I'm not going to do that. Okay, spoiler alert. When you're talking about the descendants of the 12 tribes of Israel, not just Judah, but all 12, we're talking about the unique place of the English-speaking nations. The unique place they've had in history, especially during the last 250 years. We're speaking about the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada and Australia, New Zealand, maybe parts of South Africa and Zimbabwe, maybe a few scattered elsewhere. And let me say this. Every nation is important. Every nation has a place in the plan of God. And in the end, in the kingdom of God, guess what? Everyone becomes an Israelite, if you want to look at it that way. Everyone becomes an overcomer with God. That's what Israel means. And that's the destiny of all mankind eventually. Everyone comes into Israel, comes into a relationship with God. And so, but in the meantime, in the present day, and anciently speaking, it's very helpful to understand who Israel is. So with that in place as well, it's important to understand now where we're living and where we are in history, because the world has been brought to the brink of nuclear war. We've had 1 million people killed in the Ukraine. That's a massive war on both sides. That's incredible. Endless wars in the Middle East, which have been very debilitating for the United States, with no tangible objective, really. Preventing terrorism, I guess maybe you could say that, but unbelievable as to what has happened. An immigration crisis in our nation that is reaching proportions that is unbelievable, raising violent crime rates. And associated with that, a drug fentanyl crisis that is number one killer of young people in the United States today, 18 to 45. You don't hear as much of that spoken about as you probably should. Another problematic aspect of modern life in the news media. The near assassination attempt of a former president, an economic crisis that threatens to implode the world's economy, plunge us into a depression that'll make the Great Depression look like a cakewalk. Vast pandemic that's killed millions around the world, and there's more. A lot more than that, a lot more other events that are going on. Everything I've mentioned, this is a short list, virtually everything I've mentioned is man-made, man-created. It's not God's judgment. It's not an accident. It's not God's causation. It's man's evil devices and determination, about which I've been speaking a lot about. Evil men get worse and worse. Ephesians 2 and verse 2, there is a God of this world, and he works in the sons of disobedience. We used to kind of teach that the broadcasting that's mentioned by Paul in Ephesians chapter 2 was kind of universally broadcasting and everybody's being affected in the same way. No, it specifies at the end of that verse that it specifically targets the sons of disobedience. And that's why we can reasonably calculate that there are people who are not as affected by that broadcast, of which is anti-God, anti-religion. That's in a very general sense. Every individual has culpability, but today we're looking at the real culprits. The causality is focused on not the people. I think we used to do that. We talked about how bad people were, how godless they were. Well, all people do have accountability for their actions, obviously, and they're going to be held accountable. But the major events of worldwide horrific consequence are the making of leaders, and the Bible makes that clear. Note, we're going to go to Hosea chapter 5 and verse 1 to begin with in this particular aspect. Hosea is a prophecy that includes the people of Judah and the entire house of Israel. And it begins by showing that if God punished in ancient times all of these other nations around Israel, then he's not going to let Israel get off the hook. But moving to chapter 5 and verse 1, hear this, O priests, take heed, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king, for yours is the judgment. It's speaking to those that are in leadership position, whether they're religious or whether they're civil. They're both responsible for what was going on in the nation, in the entire house of Israel. So, therefore, this message is only going to resonate with you if you understand who Israel was and who Israel is, and if you believe in the duality of prophecy, and if you believe and understand that Judah and Israel both went into captivity, respective captivities, 120 years apart, because they departed from God. And where does God place the blame? On those in the leadership position. O house of the king, for yours is the judgment. Well, we don't have priests and we don't have kings now, but we have senators and congressmen and presidents and prime ministers and so on in the nations, because you have been a snare to Mitzpah and a net spread on Tabor. The figurative language here is that of trapping prey. We've got a few hunters in the audience. A few people may have trapped at various times in their lives. This is about sneaking up on prey, and the prey are the people of the nation. Mizpah and Tabor were very likely hunting grounds, so the language here is that people were being hunted by the leaders of their own nations. It's quite interesting when we see what is happening in the world today. It happens everywhere, but we're isolating or we're specifying what's happening in the English-speaking nations who, if you don't understand it, don't believe it, get the booklet, find out, understand the, you know, that those people that lived anciently, the people of Israel, have roots in today's society, and where are they? I mean, if the Bible is relevant, and the Bible is going to be relevant, there's got to be an answer. So you got to find that out if you don't understand, at least from a intellectually or intellectual or an academic perspective. Go ahead and prove it wrong if you can. Prove that it's not so, but get into it and look to it. We can help with that. I'm going to cite to you the experience of Tommy Robinson, who is an investigative journalist in the United Kingdom. You know, they have had illegal immigration and the problems of illegal immigration in that nation as well as ours. Those immigrants entering their nation, allowed to enter their nation, come from a little bit different areas for the most part than those in our nation have come in. Probably in our nation, the conservative estimates are on the side of 10 million people in the last 4 years. I think it's higher than that. My guess would be 20 to 25 million, because they don't always capture. I mean, their estimates are not always that great. So I think it's much higher than 10 million. But they don't have that many in the United Kingdom. But Tommy Robinson, who is an activist and investigative journalist in the United Kingdom, was arrested for organizing a peaceful protest against illegal immigration and threatened with being sent to prison. And we've had the same things happen in this country too. People say, oh, that person deserves it. No, there are a lot of people who are thrown in jail that don't deserve it. This is one of them. His crime was that they said that he incited violence. Now, how many of you have been to London? Many people? You've been to Trafalgar Square? It's big, right? It's a big area. And Trafalgar Square has got a big fountain in the middle of it. It's not really a square, I don't think, but it's got a big fountain in the middle of it. And then it's got a statue that goes way up to Admiral Nelson, Lord Nelson, one of the great admirals of the British Navy. They said they put it up that high so he could look out to sea. It's a huge square. Tommy Robinson organized a very peaceful protest, and if you know anything about the British people, I mean, they're not anarchists. For the most part, they're not that way. They're peaceful, gentle people. And so if you can just imagine the entire square being filled up with tens of thousands of people who were protesting, what were they protesting? They were protesting some of the same things that are happening in this nation. The raping of women, the beating of women by illegal immigrants, and more specifically, the knife killing by an illegal immigrant who killed 6 young little girls in a daycare center while yelling Allahu Akbar. Not a religion apiece. And so he was arrested for that. They said that he was instigating riots, but you can get the film, you can see these people are not, they're just milling about. They're obviously angry. But those things are allowed in those nations, and we'll get to the reason why in a little bit. Those things are allowed in those nations, and this nation and all of Europe has been overwhelmed by illegal immigration. They've been allowed to happen by leaders, and it has brought people to a crisis point. In Hosea chapter 5 and verse 10, The Bible specifically isolates the leaders of society as being the most culpable. Hosea 5 and verse 10, the princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark. I will pour out my wrath on them like water. What does this mean? Originally, this would have to do with moving of property lines. You know, you're cheating somebody out of their property by moving their landmark. Before Judah went into captivity in ancient times, this is what was being done. But there's also a more specific spiritual reason for this. Leaders, the princes, are obscuring the difference between right and wrong. The spiritual lines, which are established by God, are being blurred. And any rational people, a person in our world today, can see that that's exactly what is taking place, and God hates that. In Hosea chapter 7 and verse 1, when I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered, and the wickedness of Samaria, for they have committed fraud. A thief comes in, a band of robbers takes spoil outside. They do not consider in their heads that I remember all their wickedness. Now their own deeds have surrounded them. They are before my face. They make a king glad with their wickedness and princes with their lies. I believe that that's an indictment not only on ancient society, but on the present society in which we live, in which the illegal and the unnatural and that which is just plain wrong is ignored by leaders. And the ones that are persecuted and prosecuted are the people that are right. And the Bible specifically says that. We're going to get to that prophecy in just a second. Hosea chapter 7 and verse 9, aliens have devoured his strength. What could be more clear about today's age? But he does not know it. Yes, gray hairs are here and there on him, yet he does not know it. Hosea 8 and verse 7, they sow the wind, they reap the whirlwind. The stalk has no bud. It shall not produce meal. It shall not, if it should produce, aliens would swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now they are among the Gentiles like a vessel in which there is no pleasure. My personal physician, I went in for a checkup here not too long ago. My personal physician was on vacation earlier this summer. He said, how was your vacation? Went through parts of Europe. He says, really excited to get to London. Hadn't been there. He said, I was on the street in London for two whole days visiting the sights and the sounds. I never heard a British accent the entire time I was there. The nation has been overrun, and not that the people who are from not British or bad or evil or wrong or bad in every case, obviously. Some are, some aren't. But I visited London numerous times when I lived there for 2 years. You find little segments, you know, you find the Indian quarter in the segment, you know, some of their areas, but basically by and large, you always heard people with a British accent. He never did. Hosea is very descriptive about the punishments to come as well as who is most culpable, the leaders of the nations. Now, Bible prophecy is often very tragic and shocking. The end result is definitely not bedtime reading, but it's necessary, and it's important for us to understand the cause and the effect and the responsibility for actions. We read in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 33 through 35. Jeremiah 25 says, and at that day the slain of the Lord shall be from one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented or gathered or buried. They shall become refuse on the ground. This is going to happen sometime in the future. Wail, shepherds, and cry. Roll about in the ashes, you leaders of the flock. For the days of your slaughter and your dispersions are fulfilled. You shall fall like a precious vessel, and the shepherds will have no way to flee, nor the leaders of the flock to escape. Now, am I saying the people themselves have no responsibility? Absolutely not. Everyone is culpable. Everyone is responsible for their own actions. And the Bible doesn't say that either. In Amos chapter 3 and verse 1, Hear this word that the Lord has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Now, that's where God placed his promises, placed his law, and expected those people to be an example to the rest of the world, and they failed. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. Can two walk together unless they're agreed? Will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Will a young lion cry out of his den if he's caught nothing? Will a bird fall in a snare on the earth if there's no trap for it? Will a snare spring up from the earth if it has caught nothing at all? If a trumpet is blown in a city, will not the people be afraid? If there is a calamity in the city, will not the Lord have done it? Now, God will eventually bring judgment on mankind, no doubt about it. But also, surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. A lion has roared, who will not fear? The Lord God has spoken, who can but prophesy? That is your job. That is our job. That is our collective job. How it gets totally accomplished, I can't tell you, but I know that it's going to happen because God can't do these things. He cannot punish mankind eventually for the leaders and their crimes against humanity and for everything that happens in the world and that is spelled out in the Bible, in the pages of the Bible. He can't do this unless there's a warning given. That's a principle of the Bible, the watchman principle of Ezekiel 33. The prophet or the one who carries the prophetic message has a responsibility to proclaim it, even in a church of God. Yeah, that's right. Oh, wait a minute. Church knows all about this. No. The church needs to wake up. In Joel chapter 2 and verse 1, it says, blow the trumpet in Zion. The trumpet was a warning. Zion is a synonym for God's government, God's people, God's church. I mean, we sing a hymn in our hymn book. Mount Zion stands most beautiful. It's not speaking about a beautiful mountain in Jerusalem. It's speaking about the people. It's speaking about God's flock. Joel says, blow the trumpet in Zion and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. It's a holy mountain, not just a physical piece of granite and rock. It's the church of God. It couldn't be clearer. Zion is symbolic of us. His church, we must hear and receive the warnings of Bible prophecy. And if need be, we need to wake up and pay attention to it. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming, for it is at hand. Now, I have no idea of the timetable, when it's all going to come down, when it's all going to come together, and when the national collapse comes. Surely, I mean, looking around, you've got to have seen differences. We have peace, safety, it's great. But you've got to see a difference that has happened in the world. So I don't know the timetable. I'm not even going into that. But when we're talking about wars, famines, pestilence, the things that, you know, we want to put off in our thinking about Bible prophecy, that's man-made. It's not God's causation. God just knows these things in advance. And our national leaders are the ones that are driving the world to battle. Eventually, I mean, I don't know what happens with the economic situation that is happening in the nation, but usually when we're on the brink of economic problems, then wars break out. Kind of odd how that happens. The debt gets wiped out, people get killed, currencies get reset, whatever. Our national leaders are driving the world to World War III and beyond. I mean, most sane people would say, this Ukraine conflict, we've got to solve this, but that hasn't been the case. Hasn't been the case. And our national leaders are primarily responsible for the escalation of all of that. So why do they do it? You know, we look for motivation. You know, the logic in our mind says there's got to be a reason that, you know, okay, if you're, what you're saying is correct, then why are they doing it? Well, I explained some of it last week. And the worldly philosophies, and the philosophies that have been expounded from the 19th century in higher education with the world's great thinkers and philosophers, their lives were a mess. Virtually all of them, all the ones that I mentioned last week, their lives were a mess. Their family lives, and most of them had no families. They were sad sacks. They were crazies. They were nuts. I'm serious. I mean, these people were considered brilliant. In some ways, they were brilliant. Machiavelli was brilliant, very evil. But these are the people that are brilliant, yet without God. So why do they do it, and what can you do about it? Well, Amos 5 is a message to the house of Israel, meaning the leadership of the nation. Amos 5 in verse 1, it says, "They hate the one who rebukes in the gate, and they abhor the one who speaks uprightly." Now, that's true in many ways in our society. You could probably find a lot of different examples of people that absolutely hate the individual that stands up for justice and for what is right. One of the reasons they hate it so much is because it shines the light back on them who are wrongdoers, the evil men. Verse 11 of Amos 5, it says, "Therefore, because you have tread down the poor and take grain axes from him, though you have built houses of hewn stone, yet you shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink wine from them." Many of our leaders today, let's just be frank about this, many of our leaders today in earlier times would be tried for treason. And the penalty for treason in a nation is death. Verse 12, "I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins, afflicting the just and taking bribes." Now, not to specify individuals, we're not going to specify individuals or isolate individuals, but it's a combination of greed, and it's a combination of that plus philosophies that shape the thinking. Why would leaders be so intent on causing the destruction of their own society? Has anyone heard the terminology "build back better"? Well, it's come from political leaders, "build back better." But if you get back into the origin of that, and it's permeated, as James and I were talking yesterday, it's even permeated our popular culture. You know, it used to be Star Wars, used to be great. I mean, it came out in 1976. Oh, a great, great series. Then Disney took it over. It's horrible. The last of the Star Wars movies is the evil genius son, who's now a rebel Jedi, he's left the Jedi, he's become demonic, tells the young girl, what's her name? Rey. "You have to kill..." I don't know if I forget your exact quote. You have to kill what you've become in order to reorganize. You know, you have to kill all this Jedi stuff. The Jedi become the focus of the destruction in the later series. It's really quite interesting. But build back better means that you have to destroy what you have now in order, because you're going to build it back. But you're going to build it back according to the Marxist philosophies that have been taught from the mid-19th century, that are the grand schemes of people that most people, if they knew them, would say, you know, that's not a person I want to really hang around with. Similar thoughts espoused by Hitler and Mein Kampf in most of those that I spoke about last week. Verse 12 of Amos 5, "For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins, afflicting the just and taking bribes." That's the other reason. You know, build back better, we got to destroy this, remake it in our own vision, even though, you know, hey, it's been working great. No, we don't like that. We don't like the democratic process. We don't like the free market system. It's evil, it's bad. Well, it's worked pretty good, actually. It's built on the foundation of the Bible, but these folks don't believe that. They don't. And verse 13, "Therefore the prudent keep silent at that time, for it is an evil time." You know, people that know better and know what's going on get to the point to where they say, you know, I'm just not going to open my mouth. Because what you find happening is that the people who, unless they can really remain anonymous, they don't want to be whistleblowers because they're afraid of their lives to speak out. We're speaking about current events. The caution in verse 14 is, seek good and not evil that you may live. So the Lord of hosts will be with you. As you have spoken, hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord God of hosts will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. You know, I have a feeling that parts of that prophecy will be given to world leaders, specifically the leaders of our English-speaking nations before all is done, all is said and done. What can you do? Well, recognize that we are at the place where we are because evil men and leaders have taken us to 90 seconds before doomsday. Pray for them. Pray for discernment. And pray that this warning is given to them.
Brethren, we have one last opportunity to sing praises to God, so please rise. And don't forget to sign the cards at the back of the table in the hall here. And let's all sing out page 152, Go Into the World. And after this hymn, the closing prayer by Mr. Bruce Love.